Ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to try to avoid using the microphone, but if when I stand away from it you can't hear me, can you please make loud noises and wave your hands and things like that?
My name is Andrew Marr. I'm from the BBC. I'm basically here in the position tonight of publisher's narc, a close inspection of Richard Layard's book, Happiness, Lessons from a New Science, will show that I like not only Richard very much, but I think that his book is fascinating. What I'm going to do, however, in the first part of this evening, is act slightly as I do on the radio programme Start the Week. I'm going to talk to Richard in a way that I hope elicits the main arguments from the book, so that first of all, we all understand what we're talking about. And we all understand what motivated him to write it and what his main conclusions are. I'm then going to probe a little bit more on three of the more controversial areas of what he proposes. And at that point, I will invite everybody to join in. Not everybody to join in, sadly, but some of you to join in, ask questions, and we'll get a bit of a debate moving around the room. I think both of us prefer to stand. Is that the case for you, Richard? Or so I was told.
I also prefer the mic.
And he prefers the microphone too. Very good. Richard, can I just start, I suppose, with the obvious thing. Is there such a thing as happiness? Is it something that can be measured, or is it entirely subjective?
Yes, happiness is feeling good and wanting things to continue that way, and unhappiness is feeling bad and wanting things to change. You can measure it. Of course, people have always tried to measure it by asking people how they felt, but there was a lot of scepticism about whether the answers related to any objective reality or were correct reports on an objective reality that might possibly be there. The big breakthrough has occurred in neuroscience, where we now have identified the areas of the brain in which happiness is experienced, in the sense that when a person says they are happy, that part of the brain is more active, and that can be measured. And the correlation between what people say or how they look to observers and what is going on in the brain is very high. So I think that puts a scotch to the argument that you can't know what's going on in other people. Actually, we couldn't have human society if we didn't. But that is an old standing philosophical argument. You can't know what's going on in other people. Therefore, how could you possibly base policy or your own private behavior on it? Jeremy Bentham, of course, who I'm the following in this book very much, he believed that it was important to aim society at making people as happy as possible. It was also that we should organize our own lives to make other people as happy as possible, and including ourselves. And I think that what's happened is that psychology, having gone through that phase of skepticism that I mentioned, has come back seriously to the study of happiness, and it has made huge progress, not only in measuring it, but in explaining it. And so we can now begin to start waving the Benthamite banner in the way that I think is really important.
We have become a sort of measurement-obsessed society in all sorts of ways, a society that thinks that if you can't count something, it doesn't exist. Mm. Does that mean that the scientific revelations of there being a sort of happiness area of the brain really does matter in moving this forward, as compared to the sort of what we might call historical common sense view that if somebody smiled a lot and had crease marks in the appropriate face parts of their face, they were probably happy?
Well, I think it will move it forward. And of course, it'll in particular, it will be moving forward our ability to deal with mental illness. But at the moment, I think its role is more in reinforcing our confidence in using what people say and how they appear to be.
This is it's a slightly unorthodox kind of book for a man of your background and eminence to be writing. We're used to reading sort of books on happiness that are are put sort of beside the cash till in certain bookshops, and they've got little peachy covers, and they give you a little bit of Eastern wisdom in it. Or we're used to those kind of books on happiness, but a book like this is something new. What was the original motivation to do this?
Well, I actually became an economist here in my 30s because I was looking for some way of thinking about social priorities. And economics is organized much more around the Benthamite approach than any other social science. The problem is it has such a narrow view of what makes people happy. Maybe lots of economists here, but I hope they realise what the economist's view is.
It's never been called the happy science, has it?
No, it's not been called the happy science. In fact, they were so worried about the word that they call it utility, which is an absolutely extraordinary word. But the basic idea in economics is that you are happier the greater the scope of your opportunities for voluntary exchange with other people. And what it really leaves out is all the ways in which we are influenced involuntarily by other people, how they impact on our aims, our aspirations, our norms, how they affect us by how they behave in the street, and so on. And it's that, all of that side of things, which explains why we have this extraordinary paradox, which is how I start the book, that although we are now two or three times richer than 50 years ago, we are no happier. To explain that, you have to bring in psychology as well as economics. And the fact that psychology has now been up and running for some years makes this a much more attractive and feasible proposition.
I'm going to probe that a little bit more in a moment. But taking that scope for voluntary exchange of commodities is...
And lives, and marriage, or whatever.
I was going to say... It's what many of us would call money as non-economists.
Mm.
Why does happiness matter? Why not simply stick with the more traditional ways and, if you like, the safer, easier ways of measuring success, which would be money, status, all the things that we're familiar with? Why go for happiness?
Well, I suppose nobody actually would think that those were adequate. But if you go through the list that somebody like Amartya Sen might produce of goods, you get a lot, like autonomy, accomplishment, freedom, and so on, and happiness is put in there as one. My position is that happiness is the ultimate good and that all other goods are good because of the way they contribute to happiness. And, I mean, if I asked you, why do you think freedom is good? You'd probably say because people feel terrible when they're oppressed, or they feel much better if they have control over their lives. But if I then asked you, why does it matter if they feel better? You might be stumped for an answer.
Reason
being that it's completely self-evident. You see, it's self-evident to humans because of the way we're constructed that happiness matters in a way it's not true of any other good.
So there is this happiness stuff. It's important. It can be measured or it can be observed to be switched on and off in the brain. Can it be measured in any other useful way?
Well, I think the really important thing, and where we get into confusion about happiness and, you know, what is true happiness, what is not true happiness, all that, is over the time period. I mean, I'm thinking of, and I think this is how scientists do think of happiness, as a feature of your state at every single moment of your life, like that you have a temperature, you're feeling good or not so good, etc. Obviously, how you feel goes up and down according to what's going on and so on, but it's going up and down for different people in different societies around different levels, and obviously the things which are more interesting for us are the average over long periods of time than the fluctuations. And those are the things which are affected by your culture, your temperament, and everything else.
And if you ask people, if a pollster asks groups of people to measure their own happiness or describe their own happiness, you think that you can draw from that data which is meaningful?
Well, I do. I mean, there's a lot of argument about this, I may say, when you come to, for example, international comparisons. Because obviously, if you're interested in the impact of culture on happiness and ideology and so on, your raw material is comparison of cultures. But most cultures have different languages. So the questions are being asked in different languages. And some people question whether the way that the people are answering the questions does convey the same, as it were, use the same standard of happiness in one country as compared with another. My reason for believing, to some extent, obviously subject to error, these measurements, is that you can explain them. John Halliwell has done a really interesting study trying to explain the difference in the average happiness of people in about 50 different countries in four different periods. And he can explain all of that variation, or 80% of that variation, by six factors. So there's obviously something in there that is really being measured. I'm not saying it's absolutely accurate.
So when we read these newspaper stories saying, you know, the Moldovans, they seem always to be the unhappiest people in the world for some reason. Someone unlikely is always happiest. I can't remember, it's the Swiss or somebody like that. It's the
Scandinavians, generally.
Scandinavians. Which doesn't... Anyway.
Well,
sorry, all Scandinavians in the room.
He is thinking of the myth that the suicide rate is highest in Sweden, when in fact it's lower than in France and Germany.
Ah, well, there we go. So if we can, we can sort of measure it or look at it, certainly inside cultures and to a certain extent between cultures, but to a less scientific extent. How are we doing on a happiness gradient? Because after all, if you just stick with this country, the United States and similar countries, we've become much richer. We have almost unimaginable material choices around us compared with earlier generations. So where do we, what does that do to happiness?
Well, over time, we have good measurements for Britain, America, and Japan. And there is no increase in happiness over the period since the Second World War. For Europe, we have measurements over the last 30 years. So there's obviously some way in which extra income is not generating extra happiness in the society. Although, and here's the paradox, within any one society at any moment in time, richer people are happier than poorer people. How to reconcile the paradox? Obviously, people must be comparing their incomes with other people. So
it's a rather grim experiment done with American students, I think you used in the book about that.
Yes. This was when they were offered two different worlds, in one of which they were poorer than in the other. But compared with other people, they were better off in the second world, and they preferred to be poorer so long as they were better off than other people. That's a very standard kind of finding. Actually, Neil Flynn here, who's been working with me on this, there are about five surveys in which you can find, if you try and just write down an equation for happiness as a function of your own income and other people's income. Other people's income is a real downer, no question.
You're saying that income equality in the end doesn't matter? Or?
No. This is not about inequality. This is a matter of, even if everybody was the same, we would not like it as much if other people... were better off.
So
and that's the thing which is kind of cancelling out the gain from our own increase in income as we go through time.
We're not an entirely admirable biped, are we, really?
No.
However, I think you also find that up to a certain point, raw extra income does bring happiness.
Yes. In every society... extra income makes an individual happier. The effect, however, is much bigger in poorer countries than in richer ones because you're nearer the breadline. It's also true that in poorer countries, as they get richer, the country as a whole gets happier. And that is why those third world countries, which are still way behind the first world, are less happy than the first world countries. But it's in the first world countries that we don't see the increase in happiness as they get richer, because it's become less important and comparisons have taken over.
And can you, is there a sort of level of income at which point the happiness tends to get no greater?
Well, above $20,000 a head, you can't see any difference in the
happiness. It's very low. really. I mean, for
it's most of Europe, Western Europe, and America. You can't see any difference in the happiness levels that's systematically related to the income levels across the countries. Yeah, that's true.
So Bill Gates is not necessarily any happier than the rest of us.
But you see, one of the points that I tried to bring out about this is that although the extra income that a person has incentive to get makes him happier because he gets happier, he gets richer relative to other people, because it's impossible for everybody to get richer relative to everybody else. So the effort is wasted. So this is one of the sort of social messages, that if you ask what does make people happy, it's the most important things are relationships. And there is the argument that we may be sacrificing our relationships too much in pursuit of this self-defeating quest for higher income.
Well, I'd like to come on to that. The list, I think you said earlier on, there were sort of four or five key factors which recurred again and again and again when you were looking at what made people happier. What are they?
Well, it's relationships. The three types of relationships are really important. Relationships with the family always come top, or with your close personal partner. Then you get work. Now, it's whether you're in work as well as whether you like your colleagues, because obviously work is a social thing as well as just an income-generating activity. Then there's relationships in the community. Then I'm taking them in your six plus income. So then you have values. You know, do you believe that the glass is half full or half empty? All these kind of things. Do you feel committed to other people, or do you think your self-realization is the main goal of your life?
That's quite close to temperament, is it? Or it's where temperament and values
collide.
Well,
but these things vary between societies. You see, the main question that's asked that we know about this from is, do you think most other people can be trusted? This is a question which has been asked in very many societies over very many years. It is a very good predictor of the important predictor of happiness differences between societies. It actually corresponds to very well what happens if you drop wallets in the street and you see how many of them return to the owner. It measures the extent to which people feel involved with other people. And I think this is very important. This is why the Scandinavians come so high. So values. On the other hand, we shouldn't rush overboard and become collectivists, because freedom is really important. Communist countries were the most miserable. And then I would say health and mental health. That's six. Plus income.
I'm quite struck by how many commentators and simply people I've talked to find the notion that happiness not only exists but is measurable and can, in theory at least, be increased by government policy mildly threatening, or at least disconcerting. Can we just finish the part where we're looking through the argument of the book by turning to the implications for public policy? You are suddenly, and perhaps unhappily, morphed into Tony Blair. you come into the cabinet. You say, right, I'm going to have an agenda for happiness. I'm going to fight this election on making Britain not a more secure country necessarily, not a more educated country, not even a richer country. I'm going to make Britain a happier country. Where do you start?
Well, I would start by looking for who is least happy, and the answer then there is the mentally ill. We now have more people who are on incapacity benefit by virtue of mental illness than we have unemployed people in this country. And the services for them are pathetic, unless they are schizophrenic or manic depressive. Otherwise, they just go and see the GP for 10 minutes and he puts them on a pill. And this is a complete disgrace. If you had any other kind of, I mean, I have blood pressure, mild blood pressure. I go to see a specialist, automatically referred. But depression is something deeply serious, and we do extremely little about it. So that would be my number one for reorienting of our public priorities. Let me mention one which might be unpopular with some of the people you mentioned. Advertising. advertising makes us want things we didn't want before and therefore feel more discontented. I think adults have to look after themselves, but I think this is a terrible thing to do to children, and indeed to do to the parents of children, to have the children insisting that they need this particular trainer or whatever, iPod or whatever is the latest thing being advertised, which everybody else has except you. In Sweden, they take that into account. They think that information should be used in public policy, and that's why they don't allow advertising directed at children under 12. I think we should seriously think about that sort of thing. But I think the third thing that I would give enormous attention to is the whole way in which we try and influence the aspirations of children in schools. I mean, they are part of public policy. And if you go into the Department of Education at the moment, you will see two huge banners, and bigger than this wall here, both of which say, "Staying Ahead." That's the object of our education, is to enable each child to stay ahead of every other child. I mean, this is appalling, but actually if you listen to the nuances of politicians in all parties, they are basically talking about, we will help you to get ahead. We're going to give you these opportunities which will enable you to get ahead. That doesn't seem to me the society we should be building, or one that's likely to be happy. And I would like to have an educational system in which we were, well, let me lean overboard now because I'm preaching Benthamism, in which the ethic that people were taught was that everybody's happiness matters equally, and that means that you should really be concerned about how well other people do as well as yourself. I think primary school teachers, to an extent, do this in different language. But I don't think secondary school teachers do it. I think secondary school teachers say, let's have a discussion about stem cell research. You know, ethics is a very interesting subject, and people have different views. Probably if the children ask the teacher what their view is, he'll say, oh, no, you've got to make up your own mind. You can't have a society, actually, ultimately, in which there is no sense of norms of social and pro-social behavior which are shared, and which people who don't stick to them are not made to feel awkward. And I think I'm not advocating a kind of education in which people are forced into pro-social behavior. You can't force people into pro-social behavior. I'm advocating a kind of education in which people grow up feeling that would be a nice thing to do, and you would feel good if you did it. I'm looking, since you ask about public policy, I'm looking for a city where this can be applied, because it's impossible for school teachers to do this. It's obviously something which ideally would be helped by a change in national television, but we won't have one. So let us at least try and create in a city an ethos in which being friendly to people and helpful to people is considered the most status-giving form of activity, that people are really liked and respected because they help people and are friendly.
They've got this thing in Italy, don't they, slow eating. This is about slow living or better living. You're also, you think there are tax implications in the end?
Well, obviously, if people in the absence of tax would be engaged in a rat race for status, which is fixed in quantity, and therefore none of their efforts can increase the total that's available, that is a waste, and we would be discouraging it by a corrective tax.
Okay,
we already have it. You see, I don't want to get branded as you're in favour of increasing the tax rate by 10% or something like that. What I'm trying to say is that taxes are performing an extra function which people were not aware of, in that they are restraining the rat race, preserving the work-life balance. And the thing to say to every tax cutter, and I hope every one of you will say this, every tax cutter you meet in the next... This is not political, is it?
perish the thought.
In the coming period... the rest of your life. do you actually want people to work harder? because that is actually the main argument for tax cutting in economic theory.
Right. Well, I mean, Margaret Thatcher certainly wanted people to work harder.
Mm.
Let me put it to you that over the past 20 years, perhaps the past 30 years, the entire social and political drive of this society, and indeed the Atlantic societies, and up to a lesser extent the European societies, has been market power and the drive to, quotes, free up, quotes, markets. And now you come along and you say, I have this science of happiness. And what it means is more state intervention in schooling, a different kind of schooling, less, if you like, less market mimicking, less about everybody trying to push to the front of a queue, that being self-evidently absurd. Taxes can actually increase happiness. I'd like to see less advertising. And I'm against the rat race. Now, what I could put to you, Richard, is this is rank socialism.
Don't use the word rank.
You've simply rebranded it happiness.
No, I'm actually in favour of a piecemeal kind of approach, because I think we are on the edges of understanding these things. But I am wanting to argue that this is the way forward. And, I mean, I've been called a totalitarian by one former chancellor yesterday and one conservative journalist the day before. And what I've said to them is, well, do you agree that the best society is the happiest? They say yes. Do you agree that we should try and find out what makes people happy? They say yes. So I say, therefore, do you not think that if we really knew what made people happy, we should use it as a basis for policy? They say no. This is opening the door. This is opening the door. This is the foot in the door of the totalitarian state. I say, you must be very unsure of your position. I mean, surely you could show us what is the effect of freedom on happiness. In fact, John Heatherwell's equations that I mentioned do show you the effect of freedom on happiness. So surely you could engage in a discussion, you know, to what extent should we reduce freedom for the sake of other goods that could be secured by intervention. And I mean, I do think that we should be a bit clear in our minds that the case for intervention is much stronger when you're talking about children and when you're talking about the least happy people than it is about the average person. There, obviously, it is right. A society has to depend primarily on the self-determining actions of prime-age adults. Let me say, in a sense, that's what I've fought for in the last 20 years more than anything else, through Welfare to Work, which is intended to get away from the victim approach to the unemployed to getting the unemployed back into being self-determining agents. But the Welfare to Work approach does not accept what, if I can say to economists, is a revealed preference view of human beings, that the unemployed cannot be miserable if they're not taking the vacancies that are there. It's a psychologically based, I always thought of it as a psychologically based policy that understood that people, after a certain amount of disappointment, can get demoralized and unable to act in what is in their best interest without a bit of a helping hand from somebody else. So Do you see it's a sort of nuance, I think, that one doesn't want the either-or approach at all. We want to look at each issue on a piecemeal basis in a nuanced way, which takes into account the realities of human psychology.
What do you think about if one alternative look at it? Oliver James has famously looked at Britain on the Couch and the low serotonin society and come up with, as it were, a non-political answer to this, which is frankly give them the drugs. We now have
I think that's a bit unfair. Well, on him, actually.
Only a bit. I mean, it's but he argues
he,
we
I
actually
I don't know if he's here.
We have
Oliver is here. Oliver here? No, sorry.
But you know, there are therapeutic, there are pharmaceutical answers to unhappiness as well.
No, of course. I mean, I'm very much, that's very much in accord with the idea of people as self-determining agents, that if you feel depressed...
So don't give them the drugs, let them take the drugs.
Well,
as it were,
don't treat them just as a victim,
yeah.
whom you are sort of managing as the GP, but if they want, obviously you can't give therapy to somebody who doesn't want it, but if they want it, enable them to understand their condition and to find the positive thing inside themselves which can lift them out of their situation. So I think therapy should be thought of as very much in line, as it were, with the semi liberal philosophy.
Fine. Let me just take a couple of steps backwards and ask what might seem a daft question, which is, do we actually want, stroke, need a certain quantity of unhappiness? Is there something in the human condition which requires that grit in the oyster to drive people forward? I mean, it's a sort of, I say, it's probably... one of the great romantic cliches about the unhappy, driven artist. I've just been reading, I was talking about this earlier with you, a book on Matisse, and you have these gorgeously beautiful, tranquil works of art created, it turns out, by a man who was miserably driven most of his life, who was working and cursing and swearing and a misery to live with, as he wrenched out of himself the art that looks serene, so serene, and which has survived him. Now, of course, you know, we're not all artists, but quite a lot of people are driven by quite painful feelings, sensations inside themselves, which push them on. And I suspect quite a lot of the people who achieve most in science as well as art, literature, politics even, are not entirely happy people, and yet perhaps we need them.
Well, let me give you a few facts. I mean, on the one side, it's certainly true that painters and writers, but not actually scientists or politicians, have been shown to be disproportionately manic depressive or depressive. That's a fact, and that might seem to support the thing. It doesn't prove, of course, that it's the suffering that is making them creative. And that the second fact is that all these studies of creativity suggest that being happy is what makes people creative, and not being unhappy. People, when they're unhappy, tend to be very uncreative. Even these people themselves were mostly, a lot of them, uncreative when they were unhappy. But how to reconcile these two facts? There's a very interesting study which has taken manic depressive people from a hospital register and looked at their creativity, higher than average, but also traced their relatives, their non-manic depressive close sibling relatives. And they are more creative than the ones who have been through hospital. I don't mean currently in hospital, but through the hospital records. So what does that say? That suggests that creativity, it was in the genes of these Matisses or whoever, that their suffering didn't actually make them more creative.
It was
made them less creative, made them less creative than they might otherwise have been. And there's been a study of manic depressive artists who've been put on lithium, and they've been asked, are you more or less creative as a result of it? And the majority said they were more creative as a result of being on lithium. So I think one should, on the whole, reject the romantic.
Maybe we should ask the audience, not just the artists, of course, whether they're more creative on lithium. All right, well, I think we've laid out quite a lot of this. I just want to end by asking this. You have gone a long way to establishing that there is not only something objective called happiness that can be measured, but that there probably are economic and political responses which can make a society happier. You've written a book about it, which is a good start. But to all those people who may respond to the arguments and respond to the book and say, okay, well, what happens now? I mean, if there were to be an agenda, a political agenda for happiness, how would it cohere What would you like to happen as a result of this book, apart from it selling a modest number of copies on which you'd be heavily taxed, of course?
Well, I think there are different levels at which you know, one would like people to respond. I mean, there's the government level where it's nice that the civil servants are taking some interest in this. There's, I think, the city level is a very important level at which to think, because that's where human relationships become real in the way that they, you can't think of them as such at the level of the country. But there's also the level of how we just talk amongst ourselves, how you and your profession discuss issues. I mean, do you automatically assume that because America's got a higher GDP per head, it must be a better society? And this used to be, I must say, the commonplace, even in the very best and pinkest broadsheet of paper. It isn't now. Happily, it ceased to be the orthodoxy. And the thing is definitely swinging back in the direction of humane values. And how come Sweden seems to be quite a stable society in spite of the fact that it has a tax rate almost double the American? I think people are beginning to realize that you can have, societies can operate with many different sets of institutions, and it's really important to see which of them are producing satisfactory patterns of life. So that's the journalistic profession, teaching profession, I think is important. I think it's important, the economics profession, that we stop assuming that the only incentives that we could possibly be discussing are financial ones, and that therefore the chief problem in life is to align pay with performance, for example. This has been very, very harmful in destroying the morale of some of our greatest professions. So it's pretty pervasive. But I also think one thing about our own academic social science profession. I mean, why should we be paid to do social science research? Presumably, in the very long run, because it contributes to human welfare. And I would certainly hope that the agenda of social science would become primarily to try and understand what are the causes of happiness.
Very good. Right. Well, on that point, I'm not going to ask in the audience when you stand up and ask a question how happy you are, or to assess your own level of personal happiness.
Nor ask me.
But I wait and see. But I'm going to take questions right away. I can see a chap in the white or light coloured shirt there. If you could kick us off. I don't know if is there a microphone in the room. There is one. Someone's coming towards you, quickly. Yeah.
Thanks. I think at an early stage in your research, you found that more culturally and ethnically homogenous societies are happier. A naive response in a totalitarian happiness-orientated state would be to put people into ethnic and cultural silos. What would a considered response be?
Well, this is an extraordinarily difficult question. Obviously, one of the major issues in our society and in the world is the issue of geographical mobility. If you start with some sort of low-level facts, which are kind of disturbing, the crime rate in an area is closely related to the extent of residential mobility, how many people have come in recently, and the best predictor of a low crime rate is how many people you know who are within 15 minutes walk of where you live. This is American research I'm quoting. So I don't think we shouldn't ignore the importance of community, and we should be very careful, and I'm now addressing my remarks to right-wing colleagues, very careful about telling everybody that they should be moving job and moving house to the highest productivity place where they could possibly get to every time they see a better opportunity, move. I mean, this is the American way of life, and it's one that American economists are preaching to us Europeans every OECD meeting. every G, probably every other G8 meeting. This is sad. But it's really important to take into account the implications for community as you can see it in particular in America.
Yes, the chap here in the...
Well, of course it's possible that people are using the words differently when they answer the questions. And as we go forward, of course, we'll be able to check this using the neurological measurements, but we can't check it backwards. Here are a few facts, though, which I think are supportive of what I said. One, if you take the same person and take that person through life, they report themselves now happier. Now, I think that the changing uses of words would be mainly be between cohorts rather than, as it were, within a cohort. Then you've got the cross-section of countries showing that the richer ones are not happier than the poorer ones within the European North American community. So that's kind of supportive of the time series. Then you mentioned depression. Now, of course, there's a lot of problems, again, with how people use the words. These measures of depression, this is a huge subject. These measures of depression are not ones got by people referring themselves to any kind of doctor or person who could help them. These are population measures of the incidence of depression. There have been some repeated studies, nearly all of which, using the same questions, nearly all of which show an increase in depression. And of course, there have been the retrospective studies, but they're subject to problems of memory recall. But I think nearly everybody who's got into this depression issue thinks that depression has probably gone up. I don't know anybody who thinks it's gone down. Alcoholism, which is easier to measure, has certainly gone up. Cirrhosis deaths have gone up in every country except France. And, of course, crime, if you think of that as in part an expression of discontent, is very much higher than it was in 1950, even if you allow for the police records not being perfect measures. So there's quite a lot of things would add up to the picture.
I'm going to try and dot around the room a bit. Yes, the lady here.
Good.
Did you come across...
Cheers.
A spiritual dimension to happiness in the sense that it might provide a purpose in people's lives as a counter to a kind of existentialist angst.
Well, one of the most robust findings in all these studies is that people who say they believe in God are happier. And in the study by John Halliwell across countries, countries were happier if there was a higher percentage of people who said they believed in God. Now, then we could discuss why that might be. One reason might be that they have a social support system through the church, but that has been discounted, and there's still some other effect there. My feeling is that if you could ask other semi-spiritual questions, as it were, that are not explicitly theological, you would get at some of the factors, like, do you feel... grateful for what life has given you. That's not a very good example, but the question of whether you think that the main issue is what you get from life or what you or what you give to life, I think is these are very very important issues and differences between people, obviously, in how they're brought up and what they assume. The whole of life is about. So I think this is an area which is just ripe for serious investigation.
I speak as an atheist myself, but certainly it also gives you opportunities for contemplation and communal getting together and music and all the other things. There's somebody, I can't remember who it was, somebody said that they'd looked through all the indexes of what brought you happiness and the importance of social interaction, music and exercise were all important, leading this person to think that folk dancing was the thing that made you happiest, quickest. Sorry, I'm going to dot around the room a little bit. Yes, this lady at the front.
One of the questions I've got is the relationship between fulfillment and contentment. Because, for example, I consider myself to be an international citizen, and that the people I find most stimulating are people who live and work in different countries. And living in London, you obviously meet a lot of those. But I'm very well aware, for example, if I spend lots of my life in stimulating environments, stimulating jobs abroad, then I won't be with my brothers, say. And there, for me, there is that distinction and dichotomy between fulfillment and contentment, both of which you could claim to be parts of happiness. I wondered if you'd looked at that explicitly.
Well, I'm trying to focus on happiness as an experience, and I think you were using fulfillment as a sort of evaluative term, and contentment as a term relating to experience, if I understood what you were saying correctly. And I think that, of course, if you feel that what you have done gives richness to your life, that should then bring you contentment. But I think if by fulfillment you mean something like accomplishment, these are the sort of phrases that Amartya Sen and others use, I think that those are, in the extreme case, false gods. I mean, there are people who have destroyed their lives by feeling they ought to do something, which disrupted everything else, but somehow they thought that they had to do it. And that's not a great thing to give excessive weight to, as opposed to reflecting on what actually makes sense to you in the round.
Bernard Crick. Bernard, just wait for the microphone. It's on its way towards you.
We all come to the microphone, Andrew. I'm all for happiness. Jefferson, Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of Happiness, and you've conjured with the name of Bentham. Slightly unhappy that the one child that Bentham and James Mill brought up had a nervous breakdown, John Stuart Mill, and then, after all, famously said, better Socrates unhappy than a pig happy. No, Mill was going too far. But it's one among a cluster of values, isn't it? And you've mentioned some of the other values, like mutual trust, or one could say freedom and truth. Could one, as Aldous Huxley parodied in Brave New World, could one be happy under a systematized delusion? I sometimes feel that about the religious, but still we'll leave that apart. could one feel happy under a complete lack of freedom in which all the things one reasonably wanted was done for one? In other words, aren't you sort of, you know, a bit like our old friend Democracy, aren't you building in an awful lot of subsidiary assumptions, or to speak like the late Isaiah Berlin, surely you are not arguing for a mono-value, for a monoculture of values, but it's an umbrella. But what are the spokes of the umbrella?
No, I am definitely arguing for the mono value. I think it's really important to think clearly. And I don't like to quote what you said back at you, but you said, could you be really happy if you had everything done for you? So you seem to be revealing that you actually would tend to think, to evaluate a situation by how happy you were. And I genuinely think that we should think about the values of freedom and so on, in terms of what they do for our well-being. And you find you must know, you've thought about these things much more than I have, but you get into a total muddle if you start thinking of freedom as a good, because, you know, one man's freedom is the other man's loss of freedom, etc. So in the end, you will find yourself balancing the effects on happiness.
You put happiness up at the top of a hierarchy, as it were, as an ultimate.
Yes, that was my philosophical thing. I'll just repeat in case nobody understood how brilliant it was. My philosophical thing is that if I ask you why you think freedom is good, we can have a discussion about it, and you'll say, well, it's conducive, and then we say, which freedom? If you said freedom of information, well, is it the freedom of you to read what the civil servant wrote, or the freedom of the civil servant to own the document he wrote? We'd have a discussion about what the impact on human happiness would be of these two different kinds of freedoms. But if I asked you, why do you think it's important if people feel good? You would not be able to give any further reason, which is my reason for thinking it's the ultimate good.
You engaged me in a Socratic dialogue about this earlier on, in which I said nothing, and you humiliated me, greatly added to my unhappiness. Yes. The question up here, chap at the front.
You suggested that one of the primary reasons for unhappiness is the relative positioning and relative inequality between individuals. And you suggest that at least when it comes to inequality of wealth or inequality of income, a political response to that would be some sort of redistribution. People also, I presume, would feel envious or jealous of different types of inequalities. It could be inequalities of talents, inequalities of intelligence, inequalities of appearance or health. Is there a political implication on redistributing any of those types of qualities?
Let me first, because I don't think I was completely clear about redistribution of income, repeat the fundamental argument for redistribution of income, which is that an extra pound makes more difference to a poor person than to a rich person. Therefore, the average happiness goes up if we take it from the rich and give it to the poor. That is something we can do. We can't redistribute the genes, but there's something quite dangerous going on at the moment, which was foreshadowed 40 years ago, I think, or even more, nearly 50 years ago, by Michael Young in his book, The Rise of the Meritocracy, where he pointed out that a society in which the most brilliant people don't always get to the top is in many ways a more tolerable one than the one in which they do get to the top, because if they don't all get to the top, they can say, I'm as good as you. But if all the best people get to the top, the question is, what is best? Now, if what is best is being at the top, and that's the only thing which really matters to anybody, going back to my previous phrase, getting ahead. If getting ahead is the basis of society, and it depends on all those interesting other variables you mentioned, it's going to be a pretty depressing society. Everybody who's below will know that they're there because that's where they belong.
So it does. You do need a multiple variety of different kinds of measurements in any society. You mustn't have a single.
Well, you want to. You want
cash.
I'm saying this is very idealistic. But you want to give more value to moral character than to simple accomplishment, don't you?
Yes, yes. Well, I speak as somebody who's violently in favour of redistribution of good looks, but there we go. There's a lady there in the white at the side. Sorry, microphone.
Thank you. Yep. I think Sigmund Freud was asked if the purpose of psychoanalysis was to produce happiness, which he rebutted and said it was to reduce misery and get it down to normal unhappiness. Isn't there a danger in making happiness the focus of what we're looking at, in that we are turning our eyes up on your hierarchical happiness good? Should we not be encouraging each other to be reducing unhappiness? And is not setting out to reduce unhappiness very, very different from setting out to increase happiness?
Well, I think there's a lot in what you say, but I just want to make one point because I didn't make it. I mean, I do think that there's a continuous scale from total misery to total bliss, and we could discuss that, but I feel that very, very strongly, and that's supported by, on the whole, the better science that I've read. But then if you ask the policy question or the ethical question, I certainly think that, I do disagree with Bentham in one respect. He was in favour of just adding up happiness. and maximizing the sum of happiness. I do think that increasing the happiness of somebody who is miserable is more important than increasing the happiness of somebody who is already very happy. And that's one reason why I think that public policy, and even how we spend our time, should be more devoted to trying to help people who are very unhappy. There's another reason, though, actually, which is in the research and has not been pointed out very much. We know a lot more about what makes the difference, what causes the difference between misery and average happiness, than what causes the difference between average happiness and great happiness. And therefore, we have it more in our power, as well as in the, as it being a duty, to do more about the least happy.
Right, gentleman there in the jacket and white shirt. I'm trying to go around different parts of the room, and I will try to get to as many people as I possibly can.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you to elaborate on the part of your speech which made me the least happy, which was the historical analogies that you drew, because obviously you're entitled to your contemporary definition of happiness as individual contentment, basically, or a neurological impulse. But it doesn't seem to me to be legitimate to draw comparisons between that and 19th century utilitarianism, or even more if you go back to the Enlightenment, because it seems to me they may have used the word happiness, but that was very much bound up with concepts of social progress, economic growth, advancing society, the, you know, the reason coming to the fore. Whereas now, all of those concepts are very much discredited. You know, we live in a period of profound social pessimism. So it may be the case that happiness exists as a neurological impulse, but the whole context and the way the term happiness is used seems to me to be very different.
Well, I hope we can get back to an era of belief in social progress. But I'm not sure what you say is true about the 18th century. I mean, Bentham was interested above all in the law and not in economics. So it was something which was meant to be pervasive through all aspects of human life.
Yes, gentleman with the beard there.
Richard, you haven't mentioned habituation, preference adjustment, mm-hmm, preference right. change tonight, yeah. Which I think is an interesting omission, given what you've written before on the subject. My concern is when you do bring in, adaptation of preferences into the argument, doesn't it make the whole issue of freedom versus happiness more of a problem? I mean, let me give you a dilemma for you to solve. Which is, I'm a benign slave owner, and for whatever reason, I want my slaves to be as happy as possible. And one of the things I do as a result of my good, or one of the results of my good deeds, is that my slaves' preferences change. They become different slaves, and they become sufficiently happy, being my property, that under no circumstances would they wish for their freedom. That's the happiest of all possible worlds for them, as a result of my manipulation of their preferences, to put it very bluntly. Should they be freed?
This, of course, is an argument that's been very much brought up by Amartya Sen, Martha Nussbaum, against the utilitarian point of view. And it sort of comes down to false consciousness, that somehow people can be induced to put up with anything. Now, first thing I would point out, which I pointed out to them, is that the Indians are a lot less happy than the Westerners. So it's not true that you just adapt to anything. This is a point of view that some psychologists do actually tend to fall into. I think it's a mistake, but they fall into the notion that you adapt to anything. It's absolutely obvious you don't adapt to mental illness or all sorts of things. And my argument with them is that if some things can be more easily adapted to than others, this is an extremely important piece of information. This is not something that should be neglected discarded, because we know, we already know that this is bad, even if the people who experience it don't dislike it. This is I find this kind of paternalism very, very dangerous. I mean, that really is much nearer to the road to totalitarianism than proper utilitarianism. So I think that a very important part of the study, you mentioned a very important area, is to try and find out what are the really, really awful things that people cannot adapt to, and equally, which is really important, what are the really good things that people don't adapt to and that make them feel better permanently? Because one of the findings which he is referring to is that one reason why extra income doesn't make you that much happier after a while is that you get used to it. You get used to the bigger car or whatever, and it doesn't feel much different from the one before.
But there
is a whole school of thought which is trying to point out that relationships, for example, a good relationship is not something which, once you have it, you get used to and you feel the same as you did before, and you can't feel any better unless you have another good relationship and so on. This is a very, very important kind of distinction.
Right, there's a chap here in the blue shirt. Sorry, it was him, I'm afraid.
Sorry. Yeah, ultimately, is it a necessary evil in society to have unhappy people and for people to experience unhappiness in order to really, truly appreciate happiness?
No, I don't actually think that's true. I know T.S. Eliot and other poets have taken this point of view, you know, thank you for giving us darkness so that we could appreciate light and so on. But some people can lead very happy lives because they have the right attitudes and the right circumstances.
Yes, a gentleman at the back there.
Lord Laird, in relation to education, you mentioned these giant banners emblazoned with "Get Ahead." And that is usually construed, as you remarked, in the sense of getting ahead of someone. In my experience, I've observed another meaning which reflects a current government initiative directed toward certain minorities, where the construction of "get ahead" would be rather different, meaning get ahead toward fulfilling your potential. I wonder whether you would concede that.
I hope that is what it means. But I would still come back to the general idea that fulfilling your potential is not an unambiguously good idea. I mean, you know, where is my potential? Just about there. So what am I trying to do all my time? I might just make it. The only things that could happen would be either I just make it or I fall short. And I think that this is one of the basic problems, actually, with the mentality which is being generated through excessive individualism and the ideology of self-realization and so on, that people are setting goals, not ones which they might be as likely to exceed or even more likely to exceed than fall short of, but ones that the best they could possibly do is just to reach the goal. I mean, this is a formula for setting up young people for misery, isn't it?
The lady in the middle there in the white stripes. There's a microphone coming to you. I'm still looking forward to the moment when politician or Chancellor of the Exchequer gets up and says, you know what, we're doing all right, just chill out. Just chill out. enough already. We've got enough. Fantastic thought. Sorry.
As an ex-scientist, I'm interested in your suggestion that there is a single scale that you can measure in the happiness, because the notes in the book mention that people self-report happiness and unhappiness at the same time.
Sure.
And elsewhere you note that self-reporting is rather accurate. And so people self-report this balancing between one factor and another. So I'm a bit doubtful if you'll ever measure that accurately in the brain. Apart from anything else, people would feel a bit unhappy being inside an MRI scanner at the same time as they're looking at the pretty picture. So that balancing, the science doesn't get you around the problem of balancing one value and one type of good against another.
Well, it's certainly true that there are different parts of the brain in which positive and negative affect is experienced. But the issue really is the time period. Now, if the shorter the time period, I've quizzed these people really closely on this because there's a lot of very confusing literature on this. The shorter the time period, the more you find that positive affect drives out negative affect or vice versa, that you don't find both of them together at the same time. This, incidentally, is the basis of Buddhism, that positive affect drives out negative affect. You can't have both positive and negative feeling at the same time. Obviously, if you go to a whole day, people will record some positives and some negatives because the time period has got longer. But I think the idea that the instantaneous, at an instantaneous moment, there is a scale going from extreme misery to extreme happiness, is on the whole the one that I have found supported in the evidence I've read.
The gentleman, three rows back in the front there, please.
Richard, congratulations on the book and for pushing this all forward. It's very, very good. This
is Netan Shah, who from the New Economics Foundation, who achieved an extraordinary coup on Monday when the government said it would consider introducing a national index of well-being.
That's one savagely critical question deflected.
Richard, you know that we agree on many, many things. One area where I think that there's an issue in terms of how you're presenting yourself is that you call yourself a utilitarian, and you say that the only thing that you think that matters is happiness. There's now a section in your book called Fairness. And what you say is that if an impartial spectator were to look at the world, what they would say is that actually maximizing happiness wouldn't be the best thing to do because that might be unequal. And so we should weight the happiness of the least well-off, the least happy.
Mm.
So to be a utilitarian, I think you need to do two things. One is you need to believe that happiness is the most important thing. And the second is you've got to maximize it. You're not doing the second anymore. Where does fairness come from? And if you believe that the impartial spectator has got a voice, then why wouldn't they consider freedom to be important as well?
Well, fairness means that each person counts equally. And I think that is a kind of intuitive sense that we all have more or less. But that is what fairness means. I repeat it because people are not always clear what it means. It means that each person counts equally. So that, for example...
Sorry, can I just interrupt? You're not saying that everybody intuitively feels that. Saying that they understand that...
They understand that that is what fairness means. That is what fairness means, that each person's welfare is of equal importance in the sense that if, we swap places... the way any one of us would judge what the right division between the two of us was would be unaffected. It doesn't matter who is in which place when you consider what is the best situation. That is not inconsistent with saying that what matters about each person is their happiness. Weighted in such a way that if they're very unhappy, we give extra account to increases in the happiness of somebody who is very unhappy. It's not inconsistent.
It's coming close to my role to make some people unhappy because we're almost running out of time. What I'm going to suggest is that I take two or three questions together and then allow you the luxury of choosing which parts of those questions you care to answer, something that occasionally happens in the House of Commons. Right, gentleman here in the blue, and then chap with his hand up at the back next, and we'll take one more after that.
Would you say that you need to know that you're happy in order to be happy?
Yes, and then the chap in the suit. I think one more, last question. Yes, no, it's all right, they come to you.
Thank you. I just wanted to, if we agree that happiness is the most important thing and that we should all strive to be happy, what happens when there are conflicting drives to happiness? For example, say a policeman chasing a criminal who catches them and it feels very overjoyed that they've done their duty, they've caught this person, they're stopping more crime, versus, say, the criminal who maybe is stealing to provide food for the family. Or you could change the actors in there, but is there a way in which we can resolve this problem, this conflict?
Fine, and I'm going to take the last question, lady there on the other side of the room.
Would you say that it's sort of impossible to be happy at all? Because at that moment you are happy, you know that it's never going to last, just like beauty never lasts, beauty always dies. It's that ultimate unhappiness in happiness.
It's the entire sort of history of Western philosophy you've got. Brief time to take us through it.
let me start with the last, which is rather similar to the first. I don't think that you need to be thinking about whether you're happy in order to be happy. In fact, there is a famous American psychologist whose name I can pronounce, but I won't, because nobody will remember it. And it's about seven syllables long. Csikszentmihalyi. He has focused on what he calls flow, which is the situation which we all know, which you get into, where you're so absorbed in what you're doing that you lose sense of time and so on. He and most psychologists believe that in that situation a person is happy, in the sense that if we could do this brain measurement, we would find that they were active in that part of the brain. But it has not yet been done. So it's an agenda that remains to tie up that particular thing. But I think that's true. I also think that the notion that you can't think about whether you're happy because it will disappear is one of the most depressing ideas I've ever heard. It is occasionally true, but in general, false. And in fact, I would recommend to people here, if they're feeling not happy, to actually try and think why they're feeling not happy, and to try and think of something that could make them feel more happy. So I think that the notion that happiness is a byproduct, which goes back to John Stuart Mill, who is probably a rather complicated person, is actually very destructive and bad idea, and I would recommend everybody to refer themselves to a Buddhist in order to resolve that problem over that particular point.
And finally, the policeman and the virtuous thief.
Well, no, I just want to also mention the trying to be happy. I mean, somebody said, should we try to be happy? That is not what I was recommending. I was recommending that you pursue the greatest happiness, and you should, in particular, try and make some other people happy. The chance is that that will actually help you to be happy, but it will surely make the other people happy, and a world in which people are behaving like that, it will certainly be a happier world than one in which people are trying individually to be happy. Coming back to the thief, this is, of course, the very deep issue of the role of rules within the utilitarian framework. And the general way in which people think about this is that the greatest happiness principle has two functions. The first function is to make you think about the rules. What rules, if generally applied, would produce a general level of happiness that was satisfactory? So a rule, you shall not steal, is one which we should in general apply because it's conducive to the general happiness, and that would apply to all moral rules and illegal rules and so on. Now then you come to the question of what if there is a conflict between rules. I mean, you didn't raise that, but you then come to the issue of what they call act utilitarianism, that you can also use the principle to decide on a particular issue where the rules are not clear. Or there are some areas where the rules don't really operate. I mean, for example, if you're choosing your career, this is what I feel most strongly, quite a good point on which to end. I mean, why is the utilitarian approach so superior to the Kantian approach, which is prevalent in philosophy departments in this country? What are the really important things that you have to think about in life? What career to adopt? What to do if there's some complete problem of family conflict? How do you think about these? I mean, there are no simple moral rules that tell you which career to adopt, but you should surely, with the best society we've won, where people chose their careers, taking into account their own aptitudes, what they enjoy doing, but also thinking about what its impact would be on other people in the society, and what would then produce the general happiness, including their own, because they're not likely to do much good unless they're happy, but they're going to be happy by doing something for somebody else.
Richard, thank you very much indeed. We at the BBC clearly have no opinions. We're not allowed to have any opinions. I'm haunted by the prospect that there might be a Daily Mail reporter in the room who's going to go away and write a story. BBC political editor hosts meeting at which Professor demands cull or purge of Kantians across British universities. But it's been, I think I'm allowed to say, indeed I have said, that it's an absolutely fascinating book. I'm certainly not only allowed but required to say it's on sale afterwards. Thank you very much for being a wonderful audience. I'm going to call on Adair Turner, director of the body which helped fund a lot of this research, to say a last few words. We've had Bentham in the room, we've had Freud, we've had Jefferson, we've had Isaiah Berlin, we've had T.S. Eliot. It's rare that you get quite such a distinguished gathering. Professor Layard, thank you very much.
Well, Richard asked me to say a few words in conclusion, and I was very honoured to accept that, because I think it's been obvious from this extraordinary conversation which has been compared, and a very interesting format, a conversation, what a very special book has been launched tonight. And it's a special book clearly because it addresses a fundamental issue, and I think the packed nature of this hall tonight shows that it has really struck a chord. I'm sure we all want to be happy. Most of us probably want other people to be happy, though there may be a few people who are made happy by being misanthropic, but there we are. But a lot of us are worried that the objectives of much of human activity and of public policy aren't necessarily making us happy, and in particular that the public policy focus on the last few percentage points of economic growth so that we feel tremendously proud if our growth is 2.3 and France is at 2.1, isn't necessarily a formula for making us happy. And what Richard has argued is that actually there's no evidence that growth of that sort is making people happy, and he's suggested a far more nuanced form of public policy agenda. Now, paradoxically, as Andrew pointed out, suggesting that nuanced public policy agenda to politicians may make politicians unhappy. But I guess Richard would argue that a little bit of unhappiness on the part of politicians would be a good trade-off in some algorithm which he hasn't quite provided us with for trading off one person's unhappiness with another person's happiness if they focused a bit more on the real issues. So it is an incredibly important book in its subject matter. It is also, however, a very important book in its methodology and the nature of its analysis. When Richard gave the Robbins lecture series last year, he revealed much of this material at that time. His lecture was subtitled, "Can Social Science Provide Answers?" And that was an interesting subtitle because it used social science in the singular, whereas we often use social sciences in the plural. And the fact that we say social sciences reflects the fact that until quite recently, while there were many disciplines in a place like the London School of Economics, of psychology, sociology, philosophy, economics, to a significant extent, they often existed in silos, intellectual silos, without all that much to say to one another. And they certainly didn't have much to say or much to hear from physical sciences such as neuroscience. Economists had to make assumption statements like, let me assume that people want to maximize X, or let me assume that people are motivated by Y, because there simply wasn't any methodology for working out how people really made decisions or what really motivated them. But increasingly, these different disciplines are coming closer together. Psychology is getting more linked to the understanding of the actual chemistry and physics of the brain, and economics is increasingly linked to an understanding of people's real behaviors and real motivations. And I think that coming together of a set of separate disciplines is actually one of the most exciting things which is happening intellectually today. What Richard's book does is combine extraordinary insights across a huge range of disciplines, from psychology to philosophy to economics, and I think that's been illustrated in the conversation this evening. Now, clearly, Richard's book has not provided all of the answers, nor it has convinced everybody of his own conclusions. I think there are some very tricky and difficult issues posed by Richard's book, and several of those have been expressed in questions this evening. How do we trade off one person's happiness versus others? Is there a sort of declining marginal happiness of happiness which we have to take into account? If people do feel happier in somewhat homogeneous societies, well, that might suggest a cautious approach on large-scale immigration, but many immigrants must surely gain happiness because they, individually, are moving up that bit of the material prosperity curve where there is a correlation between happiness and material prosperity. If people are made happy by belief in God, but sometimes belief in God is linked to attitudes we might consider illiberal and intolerant of other people, well, how do we think about that? If people are happy under a systematic delusion, is that okay? So this is not a book which provides us all the answers, but it suggests some answers, and it poses yet more questions. Richard dedicates the book to Danny Kahneman, whom he calls a fearless explorer. But I think Richard, as those of us who know him, know that he has always been a fearless intellectual explorer, always wandering into new territories, often unexpectedly. You can never be quite sure which continent he's off to next. He has, in this book, charted new territory, and he has opened up yet more territories that other people can explore. I think that is the definition of a really great book. Richard, thank you very much indeed.